Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so we're still missing people who are going to come, but we will begin. I just have a few comments to make before we start, and with these comments I will actually finish up the things that I wanted to speak about regarding previous classes. Those who have been with us for a while know that although each we have what we call them semesters, the fact is that we continue and there's people listening online and asking questions. But let me quickly finish up with some comments, and then we'll move back to where we stopped off with Ritzi Hirsch Kalischer. Just two quick corrections people pointed out to me. In previous class with dealing with Ritzi Yehuda Cook, I mentioned Rav Amital as a student of his and Rav Neria Gutel. Now, I did look into it, and it appears that Rav Amital was not technically a student of his, but he does call him in one place Moriv or Avi, something like that. So, you know, sometimes people refer to people as a teacher, even if they're not technically. You know, as for Rav Gutel, those in Israel might know him. He's one of the leading religious Zionist rabbis now. He's the president, I believe, or the rector, I think they call him, of this college, Beit Orot. He also received a PhD at Hebrew University, republished his book on Rav Kook. It's true, he came from Kol Torah, where he was from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, to Merkaz, but he came in the 80s, so he wasn't technically a student. Two more questions I want to point out, or two more points, actually one more point. You'll recall that I mentioned the position of Rav Shach, that yeshiva students should not be doing kirov work or that sort of thing, that they should be devoting themselves just to Torah study. And in fact, I found a book recently. This is the book Bina Vadat, big thick book, which develops this idea also. Incidentally, I will be discussing this book. I haven't had time because I've just been too busy to do anything else on the Sfarim blog, but I will be having a very, very long post, hopefully, when I can get around to it. The semester's ending soon, and I will discuss this book, which came out about 2 months ago, and it's quite popular. Again, look how thick it is, because this book is, if you want to talk about really outrageous books, this is an example of it. This book actually advocates hatred for the non-religious in a most obscene fashion. Now, it's true that it's full of makorot and sources, but as they say, the devil can cite scripture also. And yes, you can find sources that speak about hatred. Of course, you can also find loads of sources that speak about love for everyone. There's a whole agadic tradition, midrashic tradition of love, no matter how irreligious people are. The fact that an author would have such an approach as Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, who read this book also, I think his words he used was it's obscene. The fact that that someone would devote a book to this, and I'll cite the sources, is truly outrageous, and I know does not represent the Haredi viewpoint, certainly not in America. If it does represent the viewpoint in Israel, which again, I do not believe for a minute, then by all the chilonim, the non-religious, would be within their rights to close up the yeshivas, to force these students into regular schools, because the stuff that's being taught here, the literal hatred for the non-religious is unbelievable. The author's name, and I don't know if he's American or not, is Menachem Adler. So Dov says he picked it up. I mean, it's full of other interesting things and full of incredible makorot, but and he disagrees with people like the Chazon Ish, or he says his views don't apply, but there are certain passages he has to bend over backwards to show that because of a suffake we can save a non-religious Jew on Shabbos, but only because of a suffake. But when it comes to everything, I mean, I will give the sources later. It is really unbelievable. The name of the book is Bina Vedat. As you know, we've spoken many times about the every topic under the sun now is a whole sefer, and this topic is called Hilchos Machal LeShabbos Bizmanenu and Birur Gidrei Tinuk Shenishba. The whole idea is to show that the notion of Tinuk Shenishba doesn't apply anymore, therefore the non-religious are all evil and wicked, and all the things that were said about them. Does it have Haskamos? First of all, Haskamos, it doesn't mean they read the book or they agree with it. There are Haskamos, a couple of rabbis I never heard of, Israel Auerbach, I think he's the son of Rosh Shlomo Zalman, and Mordechai Auerbach, another son, but again, I find it hard to believe that they know exactly what's in here, and there was a long discussion on the Hyde Park forum about this, with people pointing out examples of where he puts his own view, which is a chiddush, in the text, and the standard views, he sticks them in the footnotes. You have books like this. I don't believe that a substantial portion, in fact, I did mention in the previous class that I have other books that reject the Chazon Ish and say that we are not dealing with Tinok Shen Ishva today, but I do not believe that that's the standard view. I think Jews love other Jews, whether they're religious or not religious, and of course they have anger and things like that, but to actually try to formulate in black letter law that you have to relate to these people like Goyim, that I've never heard before, I don't know what to say about it. It's a declaration of war on general society. But I mention that only because of what I was going to say about devoting time to Kirov and things. And when we did this class on Rav Shach, I pointed out that the Haredi leaders have really not accepted that viewpoint, and they have pushed Kirov for yeshiva people and the kollels. And I wasn't sure what the basis of it was, although I said that presumably they had their reasons, and I found it, believe it or not, over the summer in the Igros Moshe. I just was learning through the Igros Moshe, and lo and behold, I come across it. It's in Eben Ezer, number 26, and Rav Moshe Feinstein develops the idea. You know, Yeshiva Bachrim, they don't have so much money, I guess, so maybe this is why he approaches it this way. But he says that although in theory a yeshiva bachar doesn't need to be concerned about everyone else because he needs to develop his own learning, Rav Moshe says there still is an idea of meiser. This is on page 55. And yeshiva students, in order to fulfill their obligations of tithing, they do it by learning with people, and I learned that implies obviously cure of everything along those lines, of people less fortunate, 10%, and he says even up to 5% if they want, but they have an obligation, as he sees it, to give 10% of their time to the less fortunate in learning Torah, and that is as good a justification as you can get, and a reason for a rejection of Rav Shach's viewpoint and the Bina Vadasa's viewpoint, that the yeshiva students are not supposed to be involved in these things, because Rav Moshe says precisely they are to give of their time. So that's quite interesting. Okay, let us move on to what we're supposed to do today. We ended last class. Oh, one more thing. I see it in my notes here. I was asked a question about the Nazir, and I emailed Naomi Cohen, and she finally responded to me yesterday. Okay, so there's a lot of strange things happening out in Minnesota, I know, from Simcha. Let me be frank here. By the way, I don't know if that means sin or everything, because the Bina Vadas is not referring to the modern Orthodox. He's not even referring to traditional Jews. He's referring to the typical secularist. From the Haredi standpoint, there's a problem renting the room for the modern Orthodox. The modern Orthodox have no problem renting to the Haredim, and they do it. They do it in Chicago, they do it in other places, because the modern Orthodox see the Haredim as legitimate, just a different viewpoint, maybe misguided even. The Haredim see the modern Orthodox as an illegitimate position. So therefore, we have a double standard that if, for example, they wanted to open up a Haredi kollel, let's say, in my community, and I said, no, we don't want a Haredi kollel here, we don't like their ideology, I'd be accused of being prejudiced and closed-minded, and yet, if you tried to open up a religious Zionist kollel in Lakewood or in a Haredi neighborhood, they would shut it down, or they would attempt to shut it down. If I would say I wouldn't give money to a Haredi yeshiva, they'd say that I'm prejudiced. On the other hand, Haredi will never give money to the modern Orthodox yeshivos because they view them as illegitimate. So there is this double standard, and that's universal. You can always respect people more to your right. It doesn't work that way. But we live with that, and you have to determine, every one of you, whether you give money, whether you believe these are institutions you should support, despite the fact of these things. I mean, that's all I think we need to say about it. We know their viewpoint, and in all the modern Orthodox shuls, you have Haredi rabbis come, give shiurim, scholar in residence. You never find the reverse. So you can either look at it and say that your viewpoint is more advanced, that you're willing to see both sides, or you can be like them and say, well, the fact that they will never let your rabbi into their shul means you shouldn't let their rabbi into your shul. But we're not talking about sinna here, hatred. We're just speaking about ideological disputes. And there's a lot more to say about this, but that explains why in St. Paul they wouldn't do that. One more point. I think we all realize this, that the Haredim are a bit like, I guess you could say, a bit maybe like the Muslims, in that you find that they're very good neighbors and you can live very well with them, but when they reach a certain percentage, they start to make demands. And then all of a sudden, that creates problems, and we've seen it since you're from Minnesota. Simply, you know what they tried to do at the airport. They want to pick people up who had liquor in their car, etc. The Haredim, when they reach a certain percentage, they begin to make demands, and that creates problems. The fact is that in Israel now, you have the settlements which are entirely for Haredim. They do not permit non-Haredim. They literally do not permit non-Haredim into them. And, of course, when the non-Haredim say, well, we have an area, let's say, in Jerusalem, be it Ramot or Beit Shemesh, and we don't want Haredim in. We want to still keep the environment we have. They'll be accused of being racist and prejudiced, and yet you have Haredi areas where they literally do not allow anyone but Haredim, because the Haredi mentality today in Israel is that Haredim can only live with other Haredim. They cannot live with anyone else. Baruch Hashem, we don't have that in America. Haredim yet haven't reached a place in America where they can't live with non-Haredim. In fact, they want non-Haredim because they want to be Makariv them, but they are of the mindset, certainly in Israel, that when they reach a certain percentage, they begin to make all sorts of demands, and I mean, now we have to live with that, and now we have to figure out ways to do this. Beitar, etc. Okay, well, they might not see a problem with it yet, but they'll see a problem with it soon enough. Okay, I was asked right at the end of two classes ago, why is it that the Nazir never entered Jerusalem, never left his house, I'm sorry, after the war? And I emailed Naomi Cohen, and she gave it to her husband, Rav Shar Yashuv, the Gaon, Rav Shar Yashuv Cohen. And this is how Rav Shar Yashuv Cohen replied. The John Rabbi Hirsch, the Haredim in Israel don't like the American Haredim. That's another issue. This is Rav Shar Yashuv Cohen. The legend is, now he tells us about a legend, why he never asked his father. It's a strange thing, but okay. The legend is that my father made a sort of vow after the fall of the old city of Jerusalem into Jordanian hands, and I was seriously wounded and taken prisoner by the Jordanians. Rav Shar Yashuv Cohen was in the old city. He was wounded. In 48, he was taken prisoner by the Jordanians. And he's telling us now that this is the legend. Again, the whole thing is very strange. 19 years, from 48 to 67, Rav Shar Yashuv was with his father. He never asked him, Dad, why aren't you leaving the house? Be that as it may, I never heard it from him, but the fact remains that he left his house on the 28th of Iyar, 1967, when the old city was liberated, and went together with his colleague, Rav Yehuda Cook, over the Temple Mount, down to the Kotel to participate in Rav Gorin's first prayer at the Kotel, a historic event that was widely publicized and broadcast on the media the world over. So Rav Shar Yashuv says is that he was wounded, a prisoner, Jerusalem was captured. I guess you're supposed to take from this that his father made some sort of neder, that he would not leave, you know, if his son was returned okay, it's until the city was once again in their hands. Why Rav Shar Yashuv didn't ask his father? I don't know. If anyone knows Rav Shar Yashuv, you can ask him. But this is, I think, a historic document, what I'm holding here, the email from Rav Shar Yashuv explaining this. We ended last class, and I mentioned, actually, I created a new English word at the end of last class, reverberate instead of reverberate, but I mentioned how the Sanhedrin in Israel has been established, this quasi-Sanhedrin, and that you now have religious Zionist rabbis going up on the Temple Mount, and I even said that I don't know what Rav Lichtenstein and Rabbi Herschel Schechter, who are two of the leading religious Zionist rabbis, think about this issue. Thank you to David Eisen for knowing the answer and emailing it. I can now share it with all of you. I'm very thankful that, you know, it said the Mishnah says that you learn most from your students. I don't know if I can call you students, but at least for this hour, Mital Midaya Termei Kulam. Now, I teach at the University of Scranton, and I can tell you that I never learn anything from them. How can I learn anything? They don't know anything, these students. I'm teaching them everything. So I wasn't able to fulfill the Mishnah, but thank God, listening to, you know, when I'm in a class like this, all the emails and the things I get, I certainly learn a great deal, especially with this group, which I think is really the Echidei school of the elites in these areas. But first, David points out that, as he mentioned last class, in the Siach Nachum of Rav Rabinovich, he mentions he has a tshuva and he deals with it, and he calls attention to an article by Rabbi Sheilat on this very question. David Eisen also called my attention. I can forward you the link to a picture of a Rabinovich and a group of students. It looked like 30 or 40 from the Maale Adumim Yeshiva on the Temple Mount just a short time ago. In this tshuva, by the way, of Rabbi Rabinovich, which is a whole tshuva dealing with customs in memory of the Beis HaMikdash, he points out something interesting, which I always knew and I always found strange, and he doesn't have an answer either. According to the halacha, we are supposed to do kriya, rip our garment when we see the Temple Mount. And there was a time people did it, but today, go to the Western Wall, you'll see people coming from America, Haredim, religious Zionists, all types. No one does it anymore. And it's hard, doesn't seem to be any justification. And Rabbi Rabinovich says he doesn't know why they don't, and there doesn't seem to be any reason not to. But he says certainly you should do it when you go on Harab Ais. Again, I don't know. I asked Rabbi Chaim Rappaport about this. He said there's just some tshuvas trying to be Mohammed's foot, but I don't know. I just think people think the word, you see it on TV, maybe? I don't know. Erev Shabbos is an exception, of course, and I've mentioned a few times already, when I was in yeshiva, they told us that Erev Shabbos we should go, so we wouldn't have to do kriya. And even then, I thought that this is an example of Orthodox Jews looking for the easy way out. You're supposed to be overcome with emotion, and you're supposed to do kriya. You're not supposed to look for a way out of it by going on Shabbos or Erev Shabbos to save your shirt. Now, Ritzi Yehuda says that you don't do it, if I'm not mistaken, over Jerusalem, when you see the old city. But when you see the Har HaBayit, he also says you don't do it? Okay, well, there is a limud zchut. I had never heard that before. I understand. They come up with all these tricks not to do it, but that's the whole point. That's defeating the whole purpose of it. We're very good at coming up with these sorts of tricks. I understand that. I could sell someone's my shirt, and I don't have to do it. But that would, I think, fall into the category, perhaps, of the Ramban, Naval Birshut HaTorah. You're being a scoundrel at the permission of the Torah. If you're supposed to do kriya, you're supposed to do kriya. You're missing the forest for the trees. But people don't do it. So David Eisen reports two things. First of all, he heard from Rabbi Lichtenstein's son that although Rav Aharon will not go up because of the brisker traditions, he understands it, he thinks it's perfectly fine, and many of his Rosh Yeshiva, including Rav Meidan, who now is the Rosh Yeshiva, and the other Ramim, Rav Yitzhak Levy, who has a degree in archaeology, and Rav Shomo Levy, who's the head of the Kollel there, they all go up. And also Rav Schechter publicly stated that he was going to go up, and he thought it was a good idea, or something along those lines. He stated he was going to go up. The problem was that he was speaking at the same time that the great Rav Shomo Fisher, who happens to be, for those who don't know, the only one of the Gedol Yisrael today who, other than Rav Rabinovich, I can include Rav Rabinovich as one of the Gedolim, who really understands medieval Jewish philosophy. He's even published Rav Chassai Kreskas's Or HaShem. You can actually hear his shirim, but also see his shirim. If you go to the website, the yeshiva.il or something like that, the Beit El Yeshiva has many of his shiurim, and he apparently at this talk that Rav Schechter gave, he was also speaking, and he started arguing with Rav Schechter that you can't do that, and apparently Rav Schechter listened to him, although I don't think Rav Schechter would have changed his mind. He just, out of kavod to Rav Fisher, did not go up. In any event, for information on the Sanhedrin, you can go to sanhedrin.org, and you will find there that they too speak about offering the Karban Pesach and why it's so important. They don't explain the halachic issues, that is, they don't counter the objections to Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. There were poskim who agreed with the Sirish Kalischer. The Maritz Chayas, at least theoretically, thought we could offer the Karban Pesach. But Rav Sirish Kalischer was talking practically, and he thought we could offer all communal sacrifices. It's interesting that Rav Sirish Kalischer also accepts the Rambam's position, as we mentioned last class, that sacrifices were a concession to get people away from idolatry, but he combines this also with the idea of sacrifices as the best way to get close to God, and how it's essential to the messianic scheme and to our happiness. In fact, Jody Myers, in her book that I mentioned last class, she shows that it's precisely because Collisher was getting nowhere on this, his advocacy of sacrifices, that he turned to philosophical issues. And he wrote a sefer, Emunah Yesharah. You can find it. It's either on HebrewBooks.org or Otzar HaChachma. He also begins to engage with the Reformers, polemically against the Reformers who are gaining in power and significance. We see from his philosophical writing that Collisher had an appreciation for secular studies, although he had never been studied it, he had never been taught it in any organized way. He was an autodidact. He also supported emancipation. This was a period in which most of the rabbis in Eastern Europe, in fact, all the rabbis, I think, in Eastern Europe, with one or two exceptions, opposed emancipation. Now, how could you oppose emancipation? Emancipation means that Jews are treated as first-class citizens. This goes back to the very first class in this series, some 45 lectures ago, where we dealt with the Chasam Sofer, and the Chasam Sofer says that emancipation is a bad thing, it's going to lead to assimilation, and can anyone doubt that the Chasam Sofer was right? Emancipation did lead to assimilation, and the Chasam Sofer says we would rather be second-class citizens, where we don't have all the rights, but religiously we have autonomy, etc. It was Hirsch's great contribution to argue, no, that we need to be emancipated, that the role of the Jew is to be out there in the world, and the problem isn't, the reason for assimilation is because we need a new approach to Judaism in modern times. If you try to take ghetto Judaism in a new era, obviously it's not going to work. But that doesn't mean that Judaism is a ghetto religion. No. Judaism is for every society, and it's intended primarily for an open society. We were pushed into the ghetto, which is why we developed that way. Judaism will thrive best in an open society where Jews can have decent jobs and make good livings, and we have a mission to show the world what Torah means and what how Jews live so the rest of the world can learn lessons from our pure lifestyle. Collisher agreed with Hirsch, as did Moritz Hayes, by the way. So that makes them unique. Simply, you're back on the sacrifices thing. We will get to this with Rav Chaim Hirschenson, because Rav Chaim Hirschenson is the one who makes the case that sacrifices are from a previous era. Ratzirish Kalasher didn't think that. Now, as for Evid Ivri, you don't, Rabinovich, if you're interested, Rabbi Rabinovich has an essay in one of his volumes, which was then translated and published, it's on one of the early Adad journals, in which he argues that there are aspects of Jewish law which are time-bound. Evid Ivri, things like that, Evid Kanani, that the Torah is responding to a certain moment in time with sacrifices and the like and all these laws, and these are not the ideal. These are not the way people should live. In fact, today, if you live like this, you are not fulfilling the Torah system, but the Torah is responding, selling young girls into marriage. It's trying to take a system and trying to make it better, but this is just the beginning of a development, and now, obviously, we've reached a higher stage, and you can't say all of a sudden, well, I'm going to adopt the old way of doing things, because we've moved beyond that, and that's part of the, Rav Cook wrote about this, this is part of the development of, as we move closer to the Messianic era, and Trias Kalischer was not interested in bringing back Evid Ivri or marriage for young girls, things like that, but he would disagree with you about sacrifices being primitive. Your assumption that sacrifices are primitive, we'll see, Hirschenson has this position as well. But Kalischer would say that no, from his perspective, there's no reason to think that, and I'm not sure there is a reason. Let's wait till we deal with the debate between Rav Cook and Rav Chaim Hirschenson, because Rav Cook is prepared to acknowledge that sacrifices could be understood primitively. But that's only because we don't understand them the way we're supposed to. And in the Messianic era, there'll be a new approach, a new outlook, a new insight given to us for sacrifices, and therefore it's perfectly okay for a cook to see the old way of doing it as not suitable for today, but that doesn't mean that sacrifices per se go out the window. But we will deal with this at great length and in detail when we deal with a person sin. And I'll also even tell you about a rabbi in Milwaukee, the leading Orthodox rabbi in Milwaukee for many, many years, who also was against sacrifices and published an essay. And I'll quote to you from what Rabbi Weinberg writes in an essay in which he, too, apparently wasn't so enamored with sacrifices. But we will get to all that. Pure Samaritan, yes, we will get to all that. Rav Kook says that not everything that strikes us today as advanced is necessarily so advanced. Not everything in Western culture. And Rav Kook is one who took in a lot of Western culture. So we'll get back to all this. I promise we will deal with it. No question about it, because it's important. Kalischer, in addition to his support for emancipation, was also very impressed with people who had made it big. People like Rothschild, people like Montefiore. The idea that the Jews had to stay in the ghetto was not something that to him was so important. And not only was it not so important, it was something negative for him. It's also not surprising to see Kalischer quoting Mendelssohn and Wesley, Natalie Hirschweizel, with admiration. There are many Gedolim, incidentally, who quoted these figures. But I will say that Katz is correct. One of Jacob Katz's first essays, before he wrote his major works, was an essay on Zvi Hirsch Kalischer and his ideas of religious Zionism. And he is correct that with the exception of Zionism, I guess you'd say emancipation also, but he really focused on the Zionism, Kalischer is living in the past. He's a contemporary of Hirsch, but Hirsch and Hildesheimer are living in the present, in the future. Kalischer is still living in the past. It's not a new approach. Take his book, Emunah Yeshara. His book deals with philosophical questions, but he's speaking to a generation that's past, not one that knows German philosophy. He's not dealing with the Kantian issues. He's not quoting. The book he wrote could have been written 100, 200 years before. I think the good parallel would be, next time you're in a Sfarim store, pick up a book. Pick up one of these so-called philosophical books, and written by, let's say, people from the more Haredi world. And you could see these books could have been written 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and then pick up a book by someone like Rabbi Nataf from Jerusalem, or Rabbi Soloveitchik, or even a Rav Chaim Zimmerman, his books, and you see people who are dealing with issues raised by modernity, or now post-modernity, issues that could only have been raised by people who understood the intellectual temper of the era. And you'll see what I'm talking about. The Zvi Hirsch Kalischer really wasn't, he wasn't a man of his age, in which case he really couldn't speak. He couldn't speak to the people in his era. He did show some originality, though. In the Emunah Yeshara, I see he shows some originality, and he notes, I don't know if it's originality, let me say, he mentions something very interesting, which is, I think, very contemporary. He speaks about and develops the idea that there's two types of leaders. And if you know a traditional writer, of course, they'll have to then locate this in the past and in various archetypes. But he develops the idea that you have the rabbi and the magid. And, of course, this was the way European society worked, at least the big cities. The rabbi would preach a couple times a year. His job was to paskin shilos. That's what he did. And then you had magidin, you had preachers. Their job was to go around and preach. The rabbi didn't give sermons. This is very much an American thing. I shouldn't say an American. It's in Germany also. The Orthodox rabbis did it in Germany, and then they pick it up in America. But it's not a traditional Jewish thing. The Reform rabbis started doing it. The Orthodox rabbis also said we need to do it because German Jewry wanted sermons. And they didn't want sermons in the sense that we think of like drushas. They wanted sermons that were edifying, that help them spiritually, that it's like next time you listen to a sermon of a rabbi, you'll see, he doesn't raise a question a problem in the parsha and then come up with an answer. He always has to come up with some lesson, some moral lesson, so that he has to end it then and say something like, and we should be Zocha, you know, that in the coming year we should be Zocha with Mashiach. I mean, it always has to be some sort of edifying talk. If you would just get up and just raise a problem and answer it, people would find very strange because there's no message. Well, this is a very Germanic thing, the edifying message. The Magidim in Eastern Europe, they look at old sermons, the drushos. They quoted midrashim. They're very different. But in any event, they had two types of roles. Oh, sure. I mean, Rabbi Lookstein taught homiletics at YU. Rabbi Jung also taught that. Although I will say that the sermon is not so important for the Orthodox. Proof being that you have rabbis who don't speak well, and they're very good rabbis. And yet in a conservative movement, it's very important. Their Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur sermon, most of the congregation, it's the only time they hear the rabbi. And they spend a long time doing it. As for a kosher with Alcoy and Oliver, I'll deal with that in a few minutes when we get to his Zionism. He did have relationships, and remind me when we get to that. Alternate minions, yeah. I mentioned a few times Rabbi Hirsch, who's in Hollywood, Florida. He's a musmach of YU. He's very firm in one area because he knows the famous Ridbaz, Rav Yaakov David Wolofsky. We'll probably have some classes with him in the future. He comes to America and he attacks all these things he doesn't like about America, and one of them is things he attacks is sermons in the vernacular. That it's usher. You can only give sermons in Yiddish. So I know that Rabbi Hirsch often, he's very machmir like the Ridbaz. So whenever there's a sermon in English, which is pretty much every sermon, right, Rabbi Hirsch, he feels he's putter. He can pick up a sefer or go out. Yes, that's... so he deals with the rabbi and the magid. But the rabbi, he says, and he says the rabbi doesn't need a secular education. In modern times, Kalischer is modern enough to realize he doesn't really have much of a secular education, although he's a bit of an autodidact, but he knows that religious leaders are going to need it. But not all religious leaders. He claims that the Magid, the one who's going to give the sermons, the one who's going to speak to the people, he needs a secular education, but the Rav, since he's only poskening Shilas, it's enough for him to still be of the old-fashioned type. I think we can all see that this is not a very workable solution. You don't want a rabbi who has a culture gap. But I will say that in Germany, this took place often. In Germany, the rabbis were not the greatest Torah scholars, many of them. So who's going to poskim a shiloh? Let's say you're in a decent-sized city. You have a rav who preaches, who teaches. They would bring in rabbanim from Eastern Europe, from Poland and Hungary, and these rabbis didn't even know German, didn't even know how to speak German. But they were there to paskin shilas. That was their job. They were technicians, I guess you could call it. But that certainly is not a model for the modern time, and Hirsch is very opposed to this sort of model. One of the real problems is, if you have a model like this, the people would begin to respect and relate to the preacher more than the rabbi. Now, in Germany, it was very obvious who the rabbi was. The rabbi was in charge, and then you had the posek. So the posek, he was a technician. But if the rav is supposed to be the most important, as it is in the traditional environment, and the preacher is the one everyone relates to, you're going to have a preacher more important than the rabbi, then you have a real problem. Everyone needs to know who's most important. For example, you've had times in yeshivas where the posek of the yeshiva becomes more important than the Rosh Yeshiva. That's very dangerous. In Hasidic circles, you've had times when the Rosh Yeshiva or the Rav becomes more important than the Rebbe. And that also becomes a real problem. And the situation in Lakewood, of course, was with the famous Rabbi Abadi. He was more famous. He was being more significant than the Rosh Yeshiva. So what do you do in a case like this? Well, you fire the posek. You have cases like this. That's exactly the Hasidic model, what I mentioned, that the Rav is what they did in Germany. The Rav is a technician, and the spiritual leader is the Rebbe. Now, as at the same time that Kalischer could quote Mendelssohn, he never wavered from his attachment to Kabbalah. And let me note that despite his admiration for Mendelssohn, we see he was still a part of the old school in that he specifically rejects Mendelssohn's great claim in Jerusalem, that is Mendelssohn's book, and Hirsch agreed with this. Mendelssohn claimed, this is the theme of his little book, Jerusalem, that in modern times, diaspora Judaism should not be enforced, it should be voluntary. And when Mendelssohn said this, all the rabbis had a different opinion. They were living in the last generation of where they still had the ability to enforce their Judaism. Hirsch comes on the scene, and he agrees with Mendelssohn that in modern times, you do not. This is not how you pass on Judaism. You don't enforce it. And Mordechai Breuer wrote, before he passed away, he wrote an essay on Hirsch, how he viewed the state of Israel. And one of the things he points out is that Hirsch was very opposed to all this. You know, you force people to get religious marriages when they don't want to, that turns them off from Judaism. It creates mamzerim because they don't value a marriage, and then they get divorced. They come to America, they just get civilly divorced. They never wanted to be religiously divorced. What do we gain by forcing people to get religiously divorced? And all the other areas that we don't pass Judaism on through forcing it. That in our day, we can only do it, we're not living in a society where we have governments, you know, like an old-fashioned government. Kalischer believed that we should use the government, and there were times when the secular governments were very happy to let the rabbis enforce these things. Let me give you an example. You had cases in the 19th century in Germany where real reformist Jews did not want to circumcise their sons. Now, everyone had to be part of a community in Germany. You had to either be in the Christian community, you had to be in the Jewish community. Well, the Jewish community started refusing to register these people as Jews. And, well, then what community were going to be in? They would have to convert, or they didn't want to be Christian. They wanted to be Jews. Kalischer wanted to get the government involved in this and force these people that they, if they want to be registered as Jews, they have to pay circumcise the sons. If not, they have to pay taxes to the Christian community and the like. This is not, as I said, this really shows him living in an earlier era. It's funny because most of these rabbis who wanted to use the government to enforce religion, two generations later, when the reform were the majority, the rabbis were then arguing in favor of conscience, that they should not be forced to be members of a reform community. Hirsch was one of the only ones who argued on principle that we should not force people to be religious, because then what are we doing? We're forcing conformity, and in modern times, that doesn't get us anywhere. Kalischer, in his discussions about reform, does point out that we need to stop reform because it'll lead to a destabilization of religious life. And this is something that the government has an interest in. He's arguing the same thing that the other opponents of reform are arguing. Governments never like destabilization. Governments like conservative religion. They like things to remain the way they are. And therefore, the government will have an interest in stopping reform for the simple reason that they think it's going to be revolutionary. It's going to destabilize things. And in fact, in various places in Germany, the government did shut down, in Hamburg in particular, they shut down the Reformed Temple for a short period of time in response to the Orthodox protests. Now, Kalischer is not speaking about minor issues here. He's speaking about, for example, not circumcising your son. Elsewhere, he writes that the new settlements that are being established in the land of Israel, non-Shomer Shabbos people should not be permitted to enter the land of Israel and settle to go onto the settlements. That is, we should not permit non-religious Jews to have land in there to stroll. I'll get back to this point in a few minutes. One more thing I should note about his book, Emunah Yeshara. He does speak against the excessive stress on reason. His was an era where reason, where the idea that we have to use our reason, and that's going to determine what's right or wrong, was very much in the air. He reaffirms the notion of miracles. Miracles were under attack. You had David Hume, you had German philosophers who attacked the notion of miracles. He was aware of these philosophers in an orthodox sense. He read them or he read of them. He knew Kant, he knew Descartes. But Kalischer argues that reason must be used moderately. In other words, he advocates what today we would call, I guess, a modern orthodox perspective. The use of reason, not to believe everything under the sun, to know that Judaism is a rational, reasonable religion, but that doesn't mean that there's no room for the supernatural. Myers, in her book, shows that by the late 1850s, Collister really leaves his intellectual strivings behind, and the rest of his life, he becomes devoted to activism. You know, what leads someone from the life of the book to the activist life? I guess it's different for everyone. And people also have very different views, very different opinions on how successful rabbis are, and especially Gedolim, when they venture out of the four cubits of the Beit Midrash, of their books, to involve themselves in the world at large. We have many examples. We have examples of rabbis who do very well. On the other hand, we have examples of great rabbis who very much are out of their league and say some of the most crazy stuff and make some of the decisions which you have to ask yourself, how could anyone who knows what's going on, say these things? And I think a lot of it has to do with people who spend their entire life with the books. It makes it more difficult. In any event, Collister leaves the Beit Midrash. The first thing he does is he begins to raise money. Why to raise money? To build in Jerusalem. We have to build up Jerusalem. He also publishes his book, Drishat Zion. Here is the most picture of the most recent edition of it, 2002, Mossad Rav Kook. There's a number of editions. You have a beautiful picture here. This also has, actually, in the back of it, the letter I mentioned to you that he wrote to Amschel Rothschild. You can see the actual letter, the handwritten letter in a beautiful reprint here. There's appendices here, all sorts of things. People who followed in Rav Kook, great pictures of these people. There's all sorts of other stuff. What you don't have here, I'm surprised, is there was in a different edition. You have letters of Rav Kook, deal with Collister and the rest. You don't have there was an edition of Drishat Zion published that had halachic response relating to the sacrifice issue and other things by Ritzi Pesach Frank and others. It's not in this volume. But he published the Drishat Zion. In the introduction, he writes that in his day, that is the mid-19th century, you don't have Dor Shelet Zion, you don't have people who care about the land of Israel, who seek the land of Israel, who the land of Israel is important in their mind. What you have are people who at the end of their life go there and people give tzedakah, but that's not a Dor Shelet Zion. Nothing's tangible. And this book is about tangible things. After the book is written, after the book appears, Drishat Zion societies sprout up in various places in Europe, including London and Berlin. That is, people are so taken by Collister's vision of a resurrected life in the land of Israel, a modern life, that you can bring back the land of Israel and make it a country that people can live in, societies begin to shoot up. And people begin referring to themselves as a Dorish Zion. That is the beginning, not just of religious Zionism, that's the beginning of Zionism. See Hirsch Collister. I mean, there you have Moshe Hess, who had interesting things to say, and others, but you really have to attribute the founding of Zionism to See Hirsch Collister. Now, often scholars refer to him as the founder of what they call Chovavei Tzion, the lovers of Zion, and they distinguish that from political Zionism, which comes about later, but I would simply say that the idea that Jews can return to the land of Israel before the Messiah, indeed should return, must return to the land of Israel, and not just in old age, not just poor people to be supported, but people who are going to build a nation in the land of Israel. Ritzi Hirsch Collister is the first one to speak of this significantly. I mean, when I say significantly, Ibn Kaspi also in medieval times spoke about how we can establish the state of Israel. Spinoza mentions it also, but to write a book on it, and to have followers, I don't know who followed Moshe Hess, to have followers, we have to attribute the rise of Zionism, the whole ideology, to Ritzi Hirsch Collister. Well, why return to the land of Israel? Let's talk about it right now. Because it's not just to do mitzvos. It's everything I mentioned and more, so let's talk. By the way, he himself was ready to go to the land of Israel to supervise. He wanted to become the principal or the headmaster, whatever you want to call it, for an agricultural school that was established in Israel, or in the land of Israel, called Mikveh Israel. His health did not allow it. But Israel Hildesheimer, whom he had told he was going to go to Israel before he decided he couldn't go, and Israel Hildesheimer became a big supporter of Chalav Beit Zion, Israel Hildesheimer sends him a gift roughly equal to the entire cost of what it would, the ticket, the boat ticket, and to move his stuff. He sent him an enormous amount of money, I gather, to cover all of his expenses. Hildesheimer was himself very wealthy. He didn't take any salary for teaching. He had money. So he sends this to Sears Kalischer. And Kalischer writes back to Hildesheimer that he could not take this money for himself, and then it turns out he didn't go anyway, but he was going to make the money available to those who were coming to live and work the land. He also asks Hildesheimer, and this is when he still thought he was going to the land of Israel. He told Hildesheimer that he will take the money with him, but he'll give it to people in Israel. He asks Hildesheimer to check the medieval halachic work that deals with the land of Israel, Kaftar Vaferach, to find out if Jaffa is part of the land of Israel. Now, this is a very important question, because for agricultural laws, you need to know this. Now, he dies in 1874, never having made it to Israel. But before he dies, he arranges for Mikveh Israel, this agricultural school, to observe the laws of Shemitah. In his lifetime, Kalischer becomes the spokesman for a society, the Society for the Settlement of the Land of Israel. He published many articles in the Hebrew press, his ideas. Most people just ignored him. Yet he didn't think that he was a crazy dreamer. The political environment was such that he recognized, or he thought, that the European rulers wanted Jews to settle the land. They thought it would be valuable to them. And he had some rabbinic allies. One of the most important of his allies was Rav Eliyahu Guttmacher, the famous Rav Eliyahu of Greiditz. He lived in eastern Germany, what today is Poland. Not only was he a great scholar, he was known as a miracle worker. We have many examples of his kameas. He wrote amulets. People would come to him with their problems. Kibbutz Sadeh Eliyahu is named after him. Yes, the Netziv is also a great backer of Chalav Beit Zion and a supporter of these efforts. Rav Shmuel Moliver, Rav Reines, we'll speak about next class. These all became his backers. Many Gedolim. There's Sfarim, just of all the letters of these great rabbis for this. But they come later. Rav the Netziv really starts writing after Kalischer dies in the late 1870s, 1880s, and Netziv becomes identified with it. But Rav Eliyahu Guttmacher is important because he shared Kalischer's perspective that essential for redemption, we can't just wait for the redemption, essential for the redemption is that we must bring the land of Israel to life. We must plant there. We must bring it to life in order to bring redemption. And he also believed you could offer sacrifices. In 1860, the first conference of Chalav Beit Zion, of Lovers of Zion, took place in Torn, in Kalischer's hometown. These were rabbis and religious lay people who saw the vision, saw the dream. Now, as for the people who opposed them, Kalischer writes about them. And he compares them to the spies. Remember the spies? They go into the land of Israel. They come out. Other than Yehoshua and Kalev, they speak bad about the land. And this is regarded as a terrible thing. Because even if it's true what they said, you don't speak bad about the land of Israel. Kalischer compares the great rabbis speaking bad about Israel. What do I mean speaking bad? Saying it's a foolish idea, we can never make it work, this is for the Messianic era, the land isn't suitable for all this. These are spies. These are speaking like the spies. They're putting down the land of Israel. They're like the Meraglim. If you look at various Midrashim, they speak about that. The punishment was not what they said. What they said was true. However, you don't speak bad about the land of Israel. We have all sorts of stories of these great Gedolim who, when people came back from Israel and they wanted to tell them about the secularists and all this, they said, you know, I want to hear it. You can't speak bad about the land of Israel. you know, if you remember also the spies, part of the idea was that they said we can't conquer the land. In fact, I think it's the Kutzker who points out something interesting. Remember the Lashon, the language they use? It says that we were as grasshoppers in their eyes and in our eyes. And the Kutzker points out the real problem wasn't that they said that we were as grasshoppers in their eyes, it's that in our own eyes we were as grasshoppers. You need to, that's part of the problem. You have all these rabbis and everything saying that this is a dream, we can never do it, we have to be practical. From a Rosh Chodesh's perspective, that makes you like the spies. You have to have faith in our ability. Now, he has a lengthy correspondence with some of these Gedolim about his plans, not just to offer sacrifices, but to create settlements. Kalischer is explaining to them that, yes, we can create settlements, and I can show you, I mean, even into the 20th century, well into the 20th century, you have examples of rabbis talking about this as this is a fantasy. I'll even give you a better example. There's a rabbi in Queens named Grunblatt, Joseph Grunblatt. I believe he's in Forest Hills, I think. He tells the following story. In 1948, he was learning, and Torah Das had this kolel in Muncie. It was called Kolel Elyon. And he was learning there, and the state was proclaimed. And this older man comes in, and he's walking up and down, all agitated. And what was he so agitated about? He's going on and on, saying that it can't be, it can't be, there can't be a state. Rav Baruch Ber said it would never happen. Rav Baruch Ber said it would never happen. He was a student of Rav Baruch Ber of Kamenetz, who was a big anti-Zionist. You had, even through the 30s, the people, rabbis writing, it's a dream, it can never happen. So certainly in the 19th century. Now, one of the people with whom Kalischer had a very difficult correspondence with was that great anti-Zionist, Samson Raphael Hirsch. Kalischer writes to him, and Hirsch politely writes back, thank you, but no thank you. Kalischer continues to write him. Hirsch says to him, I will have nothing to do with your plans. Then Kalischer gets very angry, and he writes to Hirsch, and he tells him that Hirsch is hindering the redemption by staying, wanting to stay in Golos and not giving his support to settling the land. Hirsch writes back to Kalischer that what Kalischer thinks is a great mitzvah, that is settling the land, creating colonies there, Hirsch thinks is not a small avera. That is, it's a big avera. What was Hirsch's problem? What was Hirsch's problem? Hirsch had this conception, we spoke about in Hirsch's class, the class is dealing with Hirsch, that when the Messiah comes, the Jews will return to the land of Israel. He had no problem with individuals going, but he believed in this idea of the three oaths. We'll get back to these three oaths in a little while. But even without the halachic idea, Hirsch was a believer that we have a mission in the diaspora. Just like Geiger spoke about a mission, Hirsch did as well, to spread Torah values, and that when the time comes, God will bring us back to the land of Israel. One of the most interesting responses came from Rabbi Meir Auerbach. Meir Auerbach was one of the big rabbis in Jerusalem, came from Eastern Europe. He was actually the Rav of Jerusalem, as we mentioned in previous classes. All the great rabbis in the land of Israel came from Eastern Europe. None of them were homegrown. And we discussed the idea of Menachem Friedman, that when you're in a society where all people do is learn, you don't produce greatness. You need to be in a society in which people understand you have to strive for greatness, and Torah study is for the elites. He writes to Kalischer and says it's actually a good thing today that we can't go on Har HaBayit and we can't, you know, build a base of Migdash, offer sacrifices. Why is it a good thing? Well, he says go to Har HaBayit. He quotes the prophets, various prophets who speak against sacrifices. Now, these are often cited by people to say, well, that Isaiah and Hosea were against the sacrificial cult. But they were believed in a religion that was of the heart. Now, we obviously can't believe that, because we believe that these prophets were following traditional Judaism. But we certainly can say that these prophets were speaking about people who offered sacrifices without having any intentions. That is, they thought the sacrifice was like an amulet, a kameya, or like a magic. It's like the mafia guy who goes to church and does confession, or hears mass, and then goes out and kills people. You know, that would be similar. People thought that if you offer sacrifices, and that's fine. You've been, you know, you and God, everything is fine with you. But God doesn't want your sacrifices if you haven't fixed fixed yourself internally, the sacrifice is meaningless. It's just an outward manifestation of your inward tshuva or whatever you're going to do. Just like today, just mouthing the words and davening. We could have a prophet today saying, God doesn't want you to mouth the words. But you don't have anything internally that's changed. But Meir Auerbach says that the prophets are speaking, he sees the prophets speaking of a generation like we have today, he says, that we have so many non-religious people, so much irreligiosity, that if we could go on Har HaBayit and do sacrifice and everything, they would desecrate it. They do all sorts of terrible things on Har HaBayit. It'd be another tourist attraction. So therefore, it's good we can't offer sacrifices. It's good we can't build a Samigdash or anything in this era. And this is what the prophets are speaking about, because the non-religious would mess it all up. Basically, he says, we need a generation in which everyone understands, you know, the holiness of Har HaBayit before we can build it. For Kalasher, however, the people coming to the land of Israel would be religious people. And he saw great significance, messianic significance, in observing the agricultural laws. What were these agricultural laws? These were like the sacrificial laws. These were, for many years, regarded as hilchos of the Mashiach, with no significance to people's lives. People hadn't observed the agricultural laws in who knows how many years, hundreds of years. I mean, the Beis Yosef talks about them, so you had small groups that did it, but certainly for a few hundred years, no one really had observed them. And I think any large scale, you probably have to go back to temple days. So people would study in the diaspora. They'd study, even in Israel, you'd study the laws of Shemitah and of Peah and all these things. And yet, it was just like studying the laws of sacrifices or the dimensions of the Beis HaMikdash, because they weren't practical. They weren't reality. Kalasher says, we are going to make them reality. And that's part of the messianic process. I do have to say that this doesn't just come out of a vacuum, this idea of building up a land for the Jews, settling there. It develops at the same time that Jews are suffering terrible economic distress in Russia. There were many people who thought that, not just in Russia, in all of Eastern Europe, that the solution to the Jews would be agriculture. Many Jews, you have the industry starts developing in the big cities. You have textile factories. So then this means the small tailor isn't suffering terribly, being put out of business. The trains. Just think, it's not just the Jews, obviously. All these people were suffering. And then you have everyone a mass influx to the cities. Just think when the train comes about. All these people who made a living as these porters and these, you know, they'd bring people from town to town. Think of all the inns. People would travel by horseback, by wagon. They'd have to stop in every town at inns to stay overnight. Now you'd be on the train. All the businesses that were dependent on the local travel, it's like anyone from the New York area. You know, when they built Route 84, all those, it's not 84, I forget the route that goes up to the Catskills, the thruway there. Then when you got the thruway, that the little route that everyone used to go, Route 17, all the little stores on it had to close up. I mean, that's progress. Just like when we invented computers, the typewriter, people went out of business. In any event, you had terrible economic distress. So people came up with this idea that the agriculture, get people into agriculture. Kalasher even spoke about an agricultural school to train farmers. Shlomo Eger, Rabbi Akiva Eger's son, appealed to the Prussian government that Jewish farm colonies be established in Germany. We know America, we had agricultural colonies then in Argentina. They developed them. We had them in America, in Texas. I forgot the name of the place where they had the hurricane, Galveston. They had agriculture in America, in upstate New York, in Texas. So it was thought that Jews are so involved in business, being merchants. It's time for Jews to go back to work with their hands. After all, this is how Jews used to work. They used to have farms. They used to work this way. I didn't even know, Simcha, that Mikveh Yisrael still existed. So thank you. Very nice. Well, Vineland, New Jersey, you had the chicken farmers in southern New Jersey. You had farmers. My great-grandfather had a farm of sorts in upstate New York, and he used to get a Yiddish newspaper, the Yiddish Farmer or something like that it was called. So the idea was to bring Jews back to agriculture. The notion that there should be productive labor in the land of Israel was a new concept. We take it for granted today. Sephardim lived in the land of Israel. They made a living through, they were carpenters and craftsmen, things like that. But Ashkenazim didn't work. And there was a philosophical, theological idea that, you, just like there is today, that you should not work. That the land of Israel is supposed to remain a Makom Torah, a place of Torah, and a place to support elderly people who went on Aliyah until the days of the Messiah. An entirely spiritual place. We will see next class, because we still have to continue with Kalisher next class, Ratzir's Kalisher had to go up against an entrenched rabbinate that thought that the land of Israel was a messianic place. It was not a place to have agriculture. It wasn't a place to work. It wasn't a place to create a place to live. It was a place where people live a spiritual existence, and that is in opposition to any plans to make it into a real place. We will see next week Kalisher's arguments, how he develops this idea, and the impact of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalisher on subsequent generations until our own. We will also deal with a very important halachic dispute. I mentioned this last class, which is so relevant today, not just in Israel, in America, how you deal with intermarried people. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalisher comes up with an amazing idea, which really set Europe on fire with a debate over this very issue. We will deal with that next class. I see. For those who are new here, we say it'll be two classes, but we get involved and we keep going. So there's no exact end, beginning and end, but next class, certainly the first half of next class, we will be with Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalisher, maybe a little more. The plan is, though, to get to, by the end of next class at least, Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, the founder of Mizrahi. Because what Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalisher did in Chov Beit Zion, the beginnings of Zionism and religious Zionism, Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines is in the next generation. He's dealing with a political Zionism. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, it's one thing when the Chov Beit Zion were all religious. Do we now cooperate with people who want to establish a secular state? And that's going to change matters a great deal. So if we have questions, we have some time now, or comments. No, Isaac Breuer had nothing to do with Rav Kalisher, and he'd have a hard problem because his grandfather was very opposed to them. Isaac Breuer, he doesn't quote any traditional Jewish thinkers. He comes to his ideas apparently on his own. I don't think Isaac Breuer ever read Hirsch Kalisher. Rabinovich's article, it won't be hard to find. You can email me if you want. I think it's maybe issue 4 or issue 5. It's all about the idea of halacha not as a ceiling, but as a floor. That is, we have halacha, we obviously also all have to accept it, but that's not the end of it. Halacha, then we move up. And there are certain things in halacha that if you do them today, you'd be regarded as immoral. Just like the Ramban speaks about things that if you do halachically, you're immoral. You're a novel versus a Torah. We have moved beyond certain things today, and therefore, and the Torah recognizes that and is designed with that in mind. Incidentally, one of the things he speaks about, and he quotes Rav Henkin, is the capital punishment. Rav Henkin thought that the fact that we can no longer do capital punishment is a positive thing because it shows we're closer to the Messianic era when people will no longer have the urge to spill blood, and therefore the fact that we don't have capital punishment shows that we're moving closer to that era. So although the law is still on the books, that today we should be at a time where we don't want to do capital punishment. When you think about Haredi farming, you had Poli Agudas Yisrael establish it. When they established these things, though, in the 1930s, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalisher, he's already four generations gone. He spoke about an ideal. By the time Haredis come on the scene, they don't need Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalisher. They have their own ideologues. They have their own approach to it. You have this idea of Poalei Agudas Yisrael, the workers of Agudas Yisrael. So they don't need, and they don't refer to Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalisher. I have no doubt that they'd be inspired by him if they read him. And in some measure, you have to say that he's the originator of all this, because if he didn't speak about it, you never would have had people settling the land of Israel. But they are not reading him. They are not looking towards him. In fact, I think this is one of the problems, not one of the problems, this is one of the unfortunate things for Kalisher, is that everyone becomes a Chovev Tzion, but no one's really reading what he has to say. sometimes you get to a point where the ideas become so much a part of people's understanding, like today, democracy. We all are great believers and lovers in democracy. Is anyone reading the Federalist Papers anymore? I mean, if you go to university, take a class, they're reading it. Who reads James Madison? Who reads Thomas Jefferson? But we've absorbed so much of this as part of our ideology. So there's no direct attachment between Haredim dwelling in the land or Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, but I will tell you, he is regarded as one of the Gedolim in the Haredi world, unlike Reines. When Reines is quoted, he never gets the titles Gadol, Gaon, or anything like that. Kalischer gets these titles because any Chovei Tzion type before political Zionism, before Mizrahi, is still counted in the Haredi canon. It's only when Zionism becomes political and you have Mizrahi that if you're part of Mizrahi, you're out for the Haredim. Thank you, Harvey. Plato, you talk about Plato's, the way he, his society, I'm not sure. Please clarify. Breuer, well, Breuer's ideology, when you say he's the founder of Poli Agudas Yisrael, I don't mean when you know what you mean when you say he's the founder of Poli Agudas Yisrael. He was the, he was the tactician for Agudas Yisrael in Germany. That was not Poli Agudas Yisrael. He had great sympathy, and his writings became very important. And when he comes to the land of Israel, he know that he certainly is one of the people who identifies with them. But Poli Agudas Yisrael, I think, really comes out of the socialist, really socialists, both in Germany and in Poland, who are attached to Agudas Yisrael. So he becomes very sympathetic to him. But I don't know, unless I'm mistaken, I don't know what you mean when you say he's a founder. The ideology of Poli Agudas Yisrael develops independently in Poland. Okay, so he becomes the first president, but the ideology develops already in Poland. They begin talking about settling there. His book Maria and others, they become very important to them. But to say he's the founder of it, to say he's the president of it, okay, I'll look into it, exactly. But his ideology is important, but it's very much an East European Polish thing, if I'm not mistaken. But I'll get back to you more about Poli Agudas Yisrael next class. Okay, by the way, for those interested, Poli Agudas Yisrael really is not an independent entity. It's a branch of Agudas Yisrael, which is the workers' branch of Agudas Yisrael, and they take their orders from the Gedolim, from the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. What happens is that in the 1950s and the 1960s, the Poli Agudas Yisrael, the workers, the people working on the farms and the workers, as opposed to the bourgeois, they begin to think that the Gedolim, the so-called Gedolim, are not really taking them that seriously, and that their interests are different than the yeshiva types and the Gedolim. Also, the Poli Agudas Yisrael were always much more connected to the land of Israel and the state of Israel. They thought that the state of Israel was wonderful. They had their own newspaper, Shearim. They were always more Zionistic. So in the 1950s and 60s, there is a complete, first a small break and then a complete break when the Moetzes Gedolei Torah orders people who to vote for, and the Poli Agudas Yisrael agrees to be part of a coalition against what the Moetzes Gedolei Torah says. And if you look in the letters of the Stipler and others, you see harsh, harsh attacks against them. But they had their own rabbis, Rav Kalman Kahana, Rav Karelitz, I think he's Chazon Ish's cousin, and others. So they went with their own Gedolim. They did not think that traditional Agudas Yisrael represented them. Now, if you read the Agudas Yisrael literature, they're portrayed as traitors. Traitors to Torah. But they did not think that their ideology, the ideology of a workers' party, which really was socialist, was being taken into account. They didn't think that their values were being represented. So they broke with the Agudas Yisrael. And you know that when someone breaks from you, the anger directed towards him is much more. Today, all the old Poli Agudas Yisrael types are pretty much in the Mizrahi, the Chardal camp. Okay, there we see Dr. David Lando points out exactly what I was saying, how it was founded as the trade union branch, and etc. But it is true what Baruch Pelta pointed out, that Isaac Breuer, when he comes to Israel, he has this great attachment to the workers. This coincides at the same time. We have his autobiography in both Hebrew and German. Both are censored, the Hebrew more than the German, and you see his growing disillusionment with Agudas Yisrael. He dies in 1946, but by the end of his life, he thought that the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah had really missed the boat, and that he didn't understand the significance of what's happening. Okay. No, I mean, Kalischer didn't speak about socialism. We'll see next class. Kalischer spoke about settlements. But the idea of socialism, they coming from Eastern Europe, you had these people, these lowly workers, who really wanted a more equitable distribution. They did not believe in the capitalist system. They saw from their life the problems this created. And they were very happy with the kibbutz lifestyle, with labor type of governments that were had an appreciation for what they regarded as Torah values. And they, as I said, they were more Zionistic. Binyamin Mintz was one of their leading figures. You had many Gerer Hasidim who are attracted to Paul Agudas Yisrael. We'll pick up more next time, unless anyone has some comments, further comments. If not, for all those who are Americans, I wish you a happy Thanksgiving. Those who are interested in an issue which never would have been raised years ago, the halachic issues of Thanksgiving, I just plug in Michael Broyd, Thanksgiving. You find a wonderful article written by him. Those are us in Canada. What can I say? You can eat turkey too, I guess, if you want. Although it's, I don't think turkey has increased so much in price like chicken. Chickens have increased a lot. It's although beginning today, Empire says they'll be shechting 100,000 more chickens. And to you, as Simcha out in Minnesota, they're carrying in our supermarket this meat that comes from Minnesota. It's organic and everything else. So they're doing their share to fill in for Rubashkin. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Kenneth in Denver. Thank you. I'm glad you're enjoying it. Thank you very much. Good night.